Now, here we're going to jump from government documents in the JFK assassination to the Dallas conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott. And Peter Dale Scott writes, and again, this is very complicated, and the phenomenal degree of intersection, both overlapping capital participation as well as interlocking directorates and business associations, is one of the things which shows the corporate milieu, the larger economic and political forces at whose behest some of these homme de masse, some of the operational functionaries, were performing. Peter Dale Scott writes as follows in The Dallas Conspiracy. Did Johnson's phone call to Robert Anderson have any connection with the assassination of Kennedy a few hours earlier? The question, to my knowledge, has not been raised. Nevertheless, though Anderson was not in Dallas on that day and there is nothing to link him directly to the shootings, there are at least 10 connections linking Anderson indirectly to Oswald, to Ruby, and above all to those persons controlling the lives and fortunes of both Oswald and Ruby. By the way, I would interject, I'm only going to detail 7 of those 10 here. Continuing. Each of these connections may seem tenuous to the reader at first sight, but cumulatively, they suggest that the Warren Commission, aided by Wagner Carr, that was Texas Attorney General, should have explored them further. 1. Once a young Fort Worth lawyer, Robert Anderson had risen to prominence among Texas oil men as manager of the W.T. Wagner Estate, W-A-G-G-O-N-E-R, a multi-million-dollar oil and cattle-producing enterprise in Vernon, Texas. After Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested on November 22, 1963, $180 in clean $20 and $10 bills were seen in the possession of his wife, Marina. They were contained in, quote, a new wallet with an advertisement that reads, Wagner National Bank, Vernon, Texas, unquote, a family bank which was one element in the Wagner estate. Oswald, as far as is known, had never been in Vernon. 2. The Wagner estate and bank interlocked, as did General Dynamics, with the First National Bank of Fort Worth, in which Mrs. W.T. Wagner was the fifth largest stockholder. This was the bank through which remittances were sent to Lee Harvey Oswald while he was in Russia, and in which an Oswald trust account was set up by his widow Marina and her then business manager James Martin, again of Great Southwest. 3. The FBI agent covering the Oswald case from 1960 to 1962 was John Fain, F-A-I-N, who interviewed Robert Oswald about his brother in April of 1960 and Oswald himself on June 26, 1962, after his return from Russia to Fort Worth. Fain interviewed Oswald again in August of 1962 and retired in October, the same month that the Oswalds moved from Fort Worth to Dallas. Fain told the Warren Commission that he was a friend and classmate of Anderson's at Weatherford College, and that Anderson had secured him his first employment when the latter was chairman of the Texas Unemployment Commission. 4. Carl M. Loeb Rhodes and Company, that's Loeb, L-O-E-B, Rhodes, R-H-O-A-D-E-S, beginning again, Carl M. Loeb Rhodes and Company, the company in which Anderson was a limited partner, had an interest in General Dynamics, and like the First National Bank of Fort Worth, it had until 1962 a director on the General Dynamics board. Max Clark, a former security officer of the Fort Worth Convair plant of General Dynamics, was said by one witness to be, quote, in some way connected with the FBI, unquote, was one of the first people contacted by Oswald on his return to Fort Worth. Interrupting here, his wife, Gally Clark, the former Princess Sherbatov, a white Russian and part and parcel to this milieu that we're looking at. Continuing. Anderson was a co-director of Dresser Industries Incorporated, an oil equipment company with subsidiaries in Iran and Japan, with Lewis McNaughton. McNaughton's personal accountant, the Russian George Bue, took such intimate care of the Oswald family in late 1962 that he is said to have been, quote, rather mad at Marina for taking an apartment at Oak Cliff because it was rather too far for him to drive and help her when she needed help with the baby, unquote. After the assassination, Marina Oswald eventually moved in with the family of Mr. and Mrs. Declan Ford, D-E-C-L-A-N, appointing them her agents. Ford had also been an employee of Lewis McNaughton until October of 1962, about the same time that Oswald first met Ford and moved to Dallas. R.B. Gilmore, G-I-L-M-O-R-E, the president of McNaughton's firm of petroleum geologists, DeGolyer and McNaughton, was then on the board of LTV, or Ling Temco Vought. Now I'm going to interrupt the reading of the Dallas conspiracy here very briefly to read a short section. Now this also from Covert Action Information Bulletins, issue number 41 from the summer of 1992, and this is from the article with which we began, Radio Free America 37, in the George Bush and the CIA, in the Company of Friends, by Anthony L. Kimmery, K-I-M-E-R-Y. Now, bear in mind that Lewis McNaughton connected in the ways that we have seen with this particular milieu. Again, the risk of seeming repetitive, the Galen White Russian intelligence milieu, this rollback or liberation milieu. Lewis McNaughton is a director for Dresser Industries. Now, we're going to take a look at how George Bush also worked for Dresser Industries. Bush started his career as a salesman for International Derrick and Equipment Company, IDECO, a subsidiary of Houston-based Dresser Industries. This global engineering and construction conglomerate had routinely served as a CIA cover. Bush's job, peddling IDECO's services, including behind the Iron Curtain, was a curious responsibility considering Bush's inexperience in either the oil industry or international relations. And again, Bush begins by peddling oil services behind the Iron Curtain. Dresser Industries' longtime chairman of the board, now bear in mind that Lewis McNaughton of DeGolyer and McNaughton is one of the directors of Dresser. Dresser Industries' longtime chairman of the board, Henry Neal Mallon, M-A-L-L-O-N, the quote, surrogate uncle, unquote, and quote, father confessor, unquote, to Prescott Bush Sr.'s children, personally offered Bush the IDECO job. Mallon was a friend to numerous ranking Cold War and era intelligence officials, including Alan Dulles, an OSS veteran and ground floor official of the CIA. Dulles headed the agency from 1953 until 1961, when he was sacked by President Kennedy in the wake of the Bay of Pigs disaster. Mallon steered prospective candidates for spy work to Dulles and often provided cover employment to CIA operatives. Prescott and Mallon were also Yale classmates and initiates of Skull and Bones, the infamous secret Yale fraternity that was a fertile CIA recruiting ground during the Cold War. George joined Skull and Bones his junior year. Another particularly important operative with whom Mallon was well acquainted would also eventually work with George Bush, George DeMorenshield, okay, one of Marina Oswald's handlers and a former German spy. Now again, Prescott Bush Sr. was a very good friend of William Casey. We're going to look at Prescott Sr. and George's relations to William Casey next week. Henry Neal Mallon, a good friend of Prescott Bush's Sr.'s. They are both Skull and Bones and Yale graduates. Henry Neal Mallon is very friendly with Alan Dulles and also George DeMorenshield. Dresser Industries routinely serves as a cover for CIA operations and may very well have served as a corporate cover for George Bush. Henry Neal Mallon personally gives George Bush the job with Dresser's subsidiary, IDECO. Lewis McNaughton is one of the directors on this board headed by Henry Neal Mallon. Now, bear in mind here the link-ups between some of these people at the operational level and major corporate interests. Bear in mind a book which we're going to touch on also, a very fine book, a new book called The Old Boys, subtitled The American Elite and the Origins of the CIA by Burton Hirsch. As we take a look at these operational connections and these corporate, these interlocking directorates and overlapping capital participations, bear in mind the phrase networking, because what we're looking at, literally, as the title of the Burton Hirsch book says, is an old boy network. And this old boy network is what we're looking at here. So bear in mind, again, Lewis McNaughton's presence on the board of Dresser, chaired by Henry Neal Mallon, who gives George Bush his job, Henry Neal Mallon's association with with Prescott Sr. in Skull and Bones, good friend of Prescott Sr., his relationship with Alan Dulles and George DeMorenshield, And bear in mind that Prescott Sr., as we looked at in an addendum to the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, Prescott Sr. was involved with the same transatlantic financial and industrial axis, which was part and parcel not only to helping to arm and finance the Third Reich, as well as to a certain extent supporting it politically, but Alan Dulles, part of that same transatlantic financial and industrial axis, and friend of Henry Neal Mallon, helps to work out the Christian West concept. Continuing now with the Dallas Conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott. Jack Crichton, another former McNaughton employee who later worked for a Loeb Rhodes company, Empire Trust, was an oil man and the 1964 Republican candidate for governor of Texas who ran against John Connally. As a member of the, quote, Army Reserve Intelligence Service, unquote, it was he who first arranged for key Russians in the oil industry who knew all about the Oswalds to act as, quote, interpreters, unquote, during Marina's first interviews with investigators. At least one of these Russians, who knew Oswald and Clark, acted conspiratorially in systematically altering what Marina had said. A fellow director of Crichton's firm of Dorchester Gas Producing was D.H. Byrd, an oil associate of Sid Richardson and Clint Murchison, and the LTV director who teamed up with James Ling to buy 132,000 shares of LTV in November of 1963. While waiting to be sworn in as president in Dallas on November 22, 1963, Johnson spoke by telephone with J. W. Bullion, B-U-L-L-I-O-N, a member of the Dallas law firm Thompson, Wright, Knight, and Simmons, which had the legal account for Dorchester Gas Producing and was represented on its board. The senior partner of the law firm, Dwight L. Simmons, S-I-M-M-O-N-S, had until 1960 sat on the board of Chance Vought Aircraft, a predecessor of Ling Temco Vought. One week after the assassination, Johnson named Bullion, B-U-L-L-I-O-N, who has been described as his, quote, business friend and lawyer, unquote, to be one of the trustees handling the affairs of the former LBJ company while its owner was president. 7. As a Loeb Rhodes partner and director of Webb and Knapp, Anderson participated in a huge land syndicate, the Great Southwest Corporation, which hoped to turn land in Arlington, Texas, between Dallas and Fort Worth, into a $500 million investment. Webb and Knapp put in $6 million. Much of the land in question had once belonged to Anderson's former friend and employer, the late Guy Wagner, of the W.T. Wagner Estate. Loeb Rhodes and Rockefeller Center were among the original participants in the syndicate. One director of the Great Southwest Corporation, Toddie L. Wynn, had, as president of the Murchison Company, Dalada Corporation, D-A-L-A-D-A, helped pay off Anderson in connection with the oil import program settlement of 1957. Two directors of Great Southwest represented the First National Bank of Fort Worth. James H. Martin, the manager of Great Southwest's Inn of the Six Flags, became, by an intricate sequence of, quote, coincidences, unquote, host and later business manager for Marina Oswald. It was he who sold to the World Press the highly dubious pictures of Oswald waving a rifle and a Trotskyite newspapers. Today, LTV is one of the industries which have now established plants in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Now, that, again, by way of shifting focus from Elm Street to Wall Street, and we're going to complete that shift of focus. We're going to dolly the camera out a little bit further right now. Continuing with the Dallas Conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott. Now, I realize that that intersection of elements in the first part of the Dallas Conspiracy is dizzying, but again, we're talking about interlocking directorates, overlapping capital participation, and note again the connections between these links and the milieu of George Bush and this, again, this intelligence Galen-related petroleum milieu, which I have dubbed the rollback or liberation milieu. Now, we're going to dolly back all the way, and not only Wall Street, but many of the most powerful capital interests in this country and the world are now about to come into sharp focus as the beneficiaries of the reversals of policy that took place as a result of Kennedy's assassination. Now, bear in mind that Kennedy was in the process, as we looked at in the Guns of November Part 3, of pulling the U.S. out of Vietnam, that he began doing with NSA 263, National Security Action Memorandum 273, drawn up 2 days after Kennedy was killed and dated 4 days after he was killed, canceled the troop withdrawal and scheduled a 34A program of covert operations against North Vietnam, and the subsequent escalation which led to the Vietnam War. In The Dallas Conspiracy, Peter Dale Scott notes that Lyndon Johnson reversed so many of JFK's policies vis-a-vis winding down the Cold War that these reversals took place apparently not so much in response to hostile foreign developments, but rather to the pressures, domestic pressures, to continue the inertia of the Cold War, that inertia, as we have seen, generated by NSC 68, drawn up by Paul Nitze. And note that the petroleum industry, and in particular Saucony Mobile, now known as Mobile Oil, were major elements pressuring the Kennedy administration to escalate, not de-escalate, in Vietnam. Reading from The Dallas Conspiracy. Now note again, even though we have come all the way from Elm Street to Wall Street, yet again we will see people with strong intelligence backgrounds functioning in a big way as we now shift to Wall Street. Reading from The Dallas Conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott. We have been attempting to look at Kennedy's contemplated deviations from bureaucratic Cold War policy in late 1963 in the structural context of some of the defense procurement programs for aircraft and communications, which would have been most threatened by those deviations. We have also seen how, in the specific examples of Vietnam and Cuba, Lyndon Johnson moved swiftly to reaffirm before the end of 1933 a Cold War stance that was, if anything, more hawkish than before. In the case of Cuba, the, quote, full-scale reevaluation, unquote, of Kennedy's policy ordered by Johnson did not come in response to any external threat to order. The U.S. attitude toward Cuba hardened when there were signs of an improved understanding between the two countries. I would like now to raise the possibility that Johnson's, quote, crisis, unquote, decision on Vietnam at an unscheduled meeting only 2 days after the assassination was likewise in response to increased forces against peace inside America rather than to political changes in the Far East. The first ground for this disturbing allegation is that the November 24th meetings call for a decisive commitment, quote-unquote, in Vietnam, according to I.F. Stone, Johnson's, quote, hard, unquote, decision, again quoting, not to lose Vietnam, unquote, according to Tom Wicker, his decision, quote, to increase the pressure and press on, unquote, according to Steinberg, corresponded exactly to the demands over the past 6 months of powerful corporate interests whose lobbying Kennedy had hitherto resisted. These demands were publicly articulated in May of 1963 by William Henderson, H-E-N-D-E-R-S-O-N, a Saucony Mobile advisor on international affairs, unquote. We shall ultimately fail to secure the basic objectives of policy in Southeast Asia until our commitment to the region becomes unlimited, and it has not been up till now. This does not mean simply that we must be prepared to fight for Southeast Asia if necessary, although it certainly means that at a minimum. Beyond this is involved a much greater commitment of our resources, our knowledge, and our whole national effort than we have hitherto been prepared to make in order to effectively influence the political, economic, and social development of these countries along fruitful paths. Such a commitment will come, if at all, only in response to sustained and persuasive governmental, that is to say, presidential leadership and guidance. All three post-war administrations have shown an unwillingness to go the whole way to make the final commitment. And then Peter Dale Scott resumes. Mr. Henderson's paper was read at a quasi-academic conference on May 10th and 11th, 1963, quote, to reappraise the whole pattern of United States policy in Southeast Asia, unquote, sponsored jointly by the Southeast Asia Committee of the Association for Asian Studies and by the Asia Society. Neither organization could be called disinterested. Now, in the Association for Asian Studies, we're going to see a mixture of major or a conglomeration of major corporate interests, notably the Rockefeller interests, the interlocking directorate and capital participation with IBM. And again, note that many of the academics presenting these papers have intelligence backgrounds. Continuing with Scott's narrative, the AAS, this is the Association for Asian Studies, the AAS chairman of the conference was Professor John F. Cady, C-A-D-Y, a veteran of OSS in Southeast Asia, and the bulk of the papers read were by men, many of them professors, with intelligence backgrounds. The Asia Society, meanwhile, was dominated by its president, John D. Rockefeller III, whose father and brothers owned one-sixth of Saucony's stock in 1939. President Grayson Kirk of Columbia University, the chairman of the Asia Society Board of Trustees, was himself a director of Saucony Mobile, as well as of an investment firm, Nationwide Securities, with Alan Dulles, the former CIA chief, Admiral Carney, C-A-R-N-E-Y, the former chief of naval operations, and Frank Pace, P-A-C-E, of Continental Oil and General Dynamics. One can safely say it was not by accident that the Asia Society provided a platform for Saucony employee William Henderson, a professional Vietnam lobbyist from as early as 1956. Saucony Mobile itself is known to have derived 58% of its profits after taxes from foreign operations in 1959, including the Far East, and the company interlocked with others having a prominent Far Eastern stake, notably the First National City Bank of New York and IBM. And in a footnote to that last sentence, Scott adds, by the way, Saucony Mobile, that Standard Oil Company of New York, now simply known as Mobile Oil. Saucony and IBM shared two directors, Albert Lynn Williams of the J. Henry Schroeder Banking Corporation and Grayson Kirk of Columbia and the Asian Society. The Schroeder Banking operations in Britain, the United States, and Germany was one of the major firms involved in this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that I looked at in the first two Radio Free America shows, the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, and earlier in this archive show as well. Peter Dale Scott goes on to add, and by the way, Alan Dulles was deeply involved with that same Schroeder Bank. Together, these corporations have visibly had the power to use government and intelligence agencies to further their purposes. And I dare say with people such as Alan Dulles and former director of naval operations, they were obviously in a position to do so again. So as we begin dollying back from Dealey Plaza, as we begin moving back from Elm Street to get the wider focus, we see the same operational elements, the same Galen intelligence petroleum milieu functioning at the behest of the most powerful economic and political interests in this country, and the overall policies laid out by Paul Nitze in National Security Action Memorandum 68 that we looked at can be seen as being perpetuated by force of arms, by the use of deadly force and covert action in the United States to perpetuate the rollback or liberation theory rather than not just containment, but John Kennedy was actually aiming at more, if not ending, certainly winding down the Cold War to basically permit the status quo to exist. A few last quick details about this particular coup d'etat, and speaking of coup d'etat, there is a book called Coup d'etat in America, The CIA and the Assassination of John Kennedy, co-authored by Alan J. Weberman at W-E-B-E-R-M-A-N and Michael Canfield, C-A-N-F-I-E-L-D. It's published by the Quick American Archives, an appropriate name, originally copyrighted 75 and copyrighted again in 1992. A quick word of warning, this is not, in my estimation, a particularly good book. There is some good information in here, but there is a lot of serious BS, and it's generally a pretty sloppy work. But one accurate part of this book reads as follows. Speaking now of George de Morenshield, again, a friend of George Bush, friend of Henry Neal Mallon, and part and parcel to the milieu that we're looking at. De Morenshield brought Oswald to a party where he met Michael and Ruth Payne. The Paynes were closely associated with the intelligence community. Mr. Payne worked for Bell Helicopter and had a security clearance. He was worth at least a third of $1 million. Copies of a highly censored document about him were sent to Navy, Air Force, and Army intelligence. Now note again Michael Payne was not only deeply involved, worked for Bell Helicopter, he was one of its central R&D people, not noted there. And we're going to take a look again at who was in charge. We've looked at this before, not in this archive show, But we're going to take a look at who was in charge of research and development for Bell Aerospace, of which Bell Helicopter was a subsidiary. And bear in mind that Bell Helicopter profited handsomely from the Vietnam War. Reading now from a book about the importation of German scientists at the end of World War II, this is called Project Paperclip. It's subtitled German Scientists in the Cold War. It's by Clarence G. Lasby, L-A-S-B-Y, published in hardcover by the Athenaeum Press, New York, 1971. And in charge of R&D for Bell Aircraft was none other than the very same Walter Dornberger, the Nazi general in charge of the V-1 and V-2 rocket projects at Peenemünde Nordhausen, but the same General Dornberger who collaborated with Reinhard Gehlen to help generate the myth about the missile gap that we looked at in our last installment of RFA 37. Of Dornberger, Lasby writes as follows. The British did win a token victory over the protestations of von Braun. They convinced their ally to relinquish any claim on General Dornberger. They considered him a, quote, menace of the first order, unquote, who deserved to be, quote, left on the dust heap, unquote. As one Englishman explained to his American friend, the military commander of Peenemünde, quote, will ever have in mind the desirability of returning to a resurrected Reich, carrying with him the knowledge accumulated by the German rocketeers while working under Allied patronage. Unquote. The Americans were not anxious to import the enemy general. After listening to monitored conversations between Dornberger and fellow inmates of detention centers, they concluded he had a, unquote, untrustworthy attitude in seeking to turn ally against ally, unquote, and that he would be a, quote, source of irritation and future unrest, unquote, among the Germans if he were sent to America. Skipping down, but His Majesty's government had plans of their own. They imprisoned him, Dornberger, for 2 years, hoping to find some legal basis to place him in the dock at Nuremberg. Only upon his release in 1947 was Dornberger free to accept a contract under Project Paperclip, which led eventually to the directorship of research and development at the Bell Aircraft Company. Michael Payne was one of his subordinates. Whether or not Dornberger played any role in the assassination is anybody's guess. Certainly an interesting detail, possibly significant, and note that both the British and Americans observed Dornberger and his role as, quote, probably turning ally against ally. Bear in mind that Bell Helicopter profited handsomely from Vietnam. We're going to turn last, our last item here, two quick items, to Frank Wisner. Frank Wisner, a member of this old boy network discussed by Burton Hirsch. He was head of the Office of Policy Coordination, which brought in many of these Galen-related elements, including Stefan Bandera's people, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 1, and the Warren Commission Council in charge with investigating all of these white Russian-related elements was Wesley Liebler, who was an attorney with the very same law firm of Frank Wisner. Reading now from the Dallas Conspiracy again by Peter Dale Scott. Liebler's relation to the principal figures of the assassination is much simpler and more blatant than that of either Jenner or Adams. Quote, Liebler is associated with the law firm of Carter, Ledyard, and Milburn, L-E-D-Y-A-R-D-M-I-L-B-U-R-N, New York City, unquote, which is to say perhaps the most conspicuously CIA-linked law firm in the country. At one time, two alumni of Carter, Ledyard, and Milburn served simultaneously as deputy directors of CIA, William Harding Jackson and Frank G. Wisner. Wisner set up the CIA's plans division, the so-called Department of Dirty Tricks, and was directly responsible for the 1954 Guatemala operation in defense of United Fruit. Wisner stepped down and later suffered a series of nervous breakdowns after being deeply involved in the disastrous 1956 Hungarian uprising, and finally committed suicide in 1965. One wonders if his suicide has anything to do with that of Garrett Underhill, U-N-D-E-R-H-I-L-L, chief editor of the Army's Military Intelligence Service publications and a consultant on CIA, of the Army's Military Intelligence Service and a consultant on CIA-linked special operations. Quote, immediately after the assassination, a distraught Underhill told friends that a semi-autonomous CIA clique which had been profiting in narcotics and gun running was implicated. Several months later, Underhill was found dead of a bullet wound in the head. When an old friend wrote to Underhill's widow asking about his demise, the reply came from an official of a now-defunct Washington firm, Falcon Aeronautics Incorporated, which smacks of having been an ad hoc CIA front. So again, a note of Garrett Underhill's, quote, suicide, also the bullet hole in his head was the opposite, not mentioned there, was on the opposite side from what one would expect, given the hand that he used. One wonders if that has anything to do with some of the military intelligence elements we looked at earlier. The concluding item that we're going to look at tonight, again, we're going to take a look at one of the old boys. Very briefly, the aforementioned Frank Wisner, who committed suicide in 65. Reading now from The Old Boys, subtitled The American Elite and the Origins of the CIA, authored by Burton Hirsch, H-E-R-S-H, hardcover edition, copyright 1992 by Charles Scribner and Sons of New York. And old Frank Wisner himself, just like Alan Dulles, who served on the Warren Commission, just like John J. McCloy, a powerful Wall Street lawyer who served on the Warren Commission and had previously released many of the Galen operatives, including several war criminals, into the clutches of the CIA, just as Alan Dulles and John J. McCloy, part of this old boy network, served on the Warren Commission, Frank Wisner also played a very small role, albeit a journalistic one, in helping to cover up, or attempting to refute critics of the Warren Report. Reading from The Old Boys, when the English Don, H.R. Trevor Roper, presumed in the London Times to point out the sluggishness and illogic behind the Warren Commission report, Wisner took it on himself to try and whip up a campaign to refute the purported meretriciousness of the piece by Trevor Roper. So even old Frank Wisner, having had some nervous breakdowns, still figures in the background of the attempted cover-up of the assassination of John Kennedy. And again, note that Alan Dulles was a member of the Warren Commission, and John J. McCloy, who released many of Galen's most heinous operatives as U.S. High Commissioner of Germany, also a member of the Warren Commission. And this concludes this next-to-last segment of Radio Free America 37, illustrating, perhaps, as William Faulkner said, that the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past. Next week, we're going to bring we're going to bring this sequence of events all the way on up through the Reagan and Bush administrations in the concluding segment of Radio Free America 37.